Right, welcome everybody. I'm Andy Edmund of Equity Development, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Paul Jordan, Dr. Paul Jordan of Amati Global. Dare I say a veteran fund manager, but certainly someone with considerable experience. And it's hard to believe that it's probably about a decade since you founded Amati and conducted that MBO, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely right. We just had our 10th anniversary. And sadly, we haven't really been able to have any parties.
Not even sort of sensibly distanced.
Not even sensibly distanced yet. No, we're looking forward to being able to do that and to celebrate. We were planning a really big AGM for the VCT this year, and it ended up being a compliance AGM with just two people in the room. So, yeah, it couldn't have been further from what we wanted at all.
You're not going to sell too many videos of that one, I think, are you? Now, I like the idea of the AGM, so I hope I get an invite as one of the original investors.
Oh, you can take it that you're invited anytime, Andy.
And it has been a very, very good performance. We're talking now about the quoted fund, the AIM VCT, which has done, must be very nice for you to present performance measures that show good gains year to date, 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 10 year, and probably 15 years. So lots of experience to draw upon, but we have been dealing, or you have been dealing, with very novel circumstances through the course of this year, and I'm sure that investors who are watching this would be very keen to see or hear how you've navigated the COVID situation and lockdown. Whether it's made, you know, wholesale changes in the way that you've looked at the portfolio from a top-down basis, you know, whether there are sectors or indeed regions that you've decided to stay well away from and move the money into other areas. So there's rather a lot to talk about, but and maybe we'll kick off on that point. You know, if you can remember, March seems such a long time ago.
It does, doesn't it?
Did you take, as a team, dramatic action in changing the portfolio?
Well, the thing to remember about the VCT is a venture capital trust. So this portfolio doesn't change a lot. And it's very unlike any other kind of, running any other kind of fund, really, in that we have severe constraints around what we're allowed to buy under the rules. Because it's an AIM VCT, we can only buy, all VCTs can only make investments when the companies are raising money. But because it's an AIM VCT, we can only make new investments when companies are raising money on AIM in a way that qualifies for the venture capital rules. And those are relatively rare events. So what we don't ever do with it is just sort of say, oh, we think X, Y, Z is going to happen, so let's change the portfolio. We don't have that sort of, we don't have that luxury in a way, but also in some ways it's a big advantage to not have that particular thing to think about, because it means that by definition we tend to be pretty long-term investors in really all of our holdings.
And is the same true for the smaller companies fund, which is the larger of the two?
No, I mean, not at all. I mean, with the small companies fund, we do still regard ourselves as long-term investors. That's what we're in the business of doing. But that fund can change its emphasis much more readily, and we can respond more to what we think is going to happen next in the market and more quickly in that fund, because we can buy any shares that are quoted on the market, whereas the VCT can't do that. It can only buy them at very specific times. And as a result, one thing we've been talking a lot about in the reports in the VCT over the last 5 years pretty much is, you know, we very consciously decided that we would adopt a strategy of running winners in the portfolio, which has meant that some of the holdings are really pretty large investments, and there's more concentration in the VCT than there is in our small companies fund. You know, our biggest holding is over 8% of the assets of the fund now. And that was a very, you know, it was a clearly a conscious decision that we made, that this was the best way to run the VCT. And what we were hoping for, and this is by and large what's happened, is that the winners in the portfolio would mature as companies. They would become profitable mid-sized businesses with good growth opportunities. And they'd be a million miles from the kind of things we can make new investments in, which are you know, early stage, probably loss-making or break-even companies with ambitious plans, but yet to prove them. And by running the winners, what it does is it means that the bulk of the assets of the portfolio, so the significant weighting in the portfolio, is towards companies that have matured. And you know, the newer investments in the portfolio, which are not a very large proportion of the portfolio as a whole, are riskier, but also full of opportunity. And so, if you like, they will then feed the next set of companies that grow and you know, mature and add a lot of value to the portfolio. Obviously, some will fall by the wayside, those that don't make it. And you know, but in the way that particular scheme works is, you know, we can, the ones, the investments that don't make it don't destroy the performance and they don't destroy the portfolio, because you know, we've got such a big weighting in companies that we've been very long-term patient investors in, and they've now matured. You know, they really dominate what's going to happen in the performance in the short term. And in the long term, you know, if we get contributions from newer investments that come through successfully, you know, that's just upside.
Yeah, well, it does seem a long time ago, but you will have in the VCT funds that will have shown a gain of 1,000% or more, presumably, over that long-term period we've been talking about. And that presumably translated into, or hopefully translates into, significant increases in market capitalization. So you'll know the names better than me, but I would imagine Frontier and Keywords are some of the shining examples that you could hold up as being companies of 50 or 100 million cap when they came to the market, or when you first looked at them. But they've now got a few noughts added to that.
You know, exactly. And what I love to show investors is what I call our bubble graphs, which you might be able to bring up on the screen, which really trace, it's a kind of animation from 2015 to 20. And these bubbles, really each one shows, represents an investment in the portfolio, and the size of the bubble shows you the weight of that investment in the portfolio. It's the size of the investment. And you can see back in 2015, you know, we had some companies that were as much as 200 million in market cap, and we were feeling pretty good about that. We thought, actually, this is even that was a long way from where we were in 2010, when anything over sort of 50 million was big and mature in terms of our portfolio. By 2015, we had a clutch of companies at 200 million. And then, as you can see, as we click through these slides, we go, you know, 2016, we had reached 400 million. 2017, GB Group, Accesso, Brooks McDonald, Quixent were, you know, 600 million at the larger end. And then by the time we got to 2018, that's when we first saw portfolio holdings go over £1 billion market cap, which were Keywords, GB Group, you know, and a couple of, well, several others were over 500 million. And so, you know, this phenomenon I'm talking about is not just one or two holdings in the portfolio. It's a scattering of holdings and are really successful investments. And then, you know, we wind on 2019, it's a similar picture. And when we get to 2020, you know, it's still very much the same. And what you might notice in the 2020 bubble graph is that some of the newer investments we've been making under the new rules, and the rules did change very significantly in 2016, 17, 18, so that new investments effectively had to become riskier, and a bit earlier stage, and we had, you know, some proving to do that we could make this model work. And we never want to make investments just for the sake of it. We're only going to make new investments where we think they really have the potential to add a lot of value to the portfolio in the longer term, but we have to be patient. And this year you can start to see some of the newer investments reach, you know, 300-400 million in market cap and start to become really significant companies in their own right. And that's been, you know, it's been really pleasing to see. And I think that this is hopefully demonstrating that there is a sustainable and workable model here for you know, fund performance, but also, you know, doing exactly what a VCT should do, supporting the next generation of growth companies, and in our case, AIM quoted growth companies in the UK. I mean, there's one other theme which would be worth sort of touching on early on here is, and again, we were talking about this actually for a few years, that since the rules changed in particular, that, you know, many of the best opportunities we were seeing in the portfolio were starting to be in the healthcare sector. And so the weighting in the healthcare sector started to rise you know, significantly 2018, 19, 20. And we had that been 10 years earlier, I'd been nervous about it. And you know, so trying to stand back from this, because I think this is a really big trend that is worth sort of focusing on for a few minutes. You know, we're all very familiar with the industrial revolution that is to do with digital technology and the implementation of digital technology. And if you think about it, that industrial revolution has like a 50-year sweep to it. It maybe you could say it starts possibly with the invention of the microcomputer in the very early 70s, and it reaches its point of frenzy in the year 1998, 1999, 2000 with the dot-com boom, and then there's a big crash and a crunch. And then really the last decade has been something of a, what one might call a golden age for digital technology and its implementation. And in that golden age, smaller companies have been able to implement new technology very effectively and to use it to challenge much larger, more established businesses successfully. And that created a lot of value for smaller company investors like ourselves. You know, when I stand back from what we've seen since Amati began over the last decade, you know, that's been one of the big drivers of performance. And it's one reason why we've been able to, you know, see really good performance in the funds. But then, you know, I think what's happened now to that theme is that it's matured a great deal. And it's I don't think it's so any longer the case that it's easy to do a new digital technology startup, get the capital, compete effectively, have a brilliant idea that nobody's thought of, and implement it, and you know, and 5 years' time, you've got the next train line or Skyscanner or whatever it is. You know, it's much, much more crowded market. It plays more again into the hands of medium-sized and larger businesses, and you know, it's reverting to what one might think of as being a more mature phase of industrial development. Less easy for microcap type investing or early stage investing. Whereas the healthcare sector really has had a similarly long trajectory of technology development. And there are many technologies in healthcare which have been, you know, being developed over the last 30, 40 years. And if I think of cell therapy, gene therapy, immunotherapy, you know, these are massive developments and huge technological advances. But I think, and I felt for a few years, that we're getting to the point now where it's, to me, seems quite conceivable that we have a bit of a, you know, that kind of golden age era where actually those technologies become commercialized, and then often by, you know, quite small companies who've had the technology, they've been beavering away at it for many years. And we've now reached a point of where, you know, drugs are getting approved, diagnostics are required in a way they've never been before, and they can use genomics to do all kinds of diagnoses that would be conceivable a few years before. Immunotherapy has come on in leaps and bounds. And, you know, we're starting to see these things being commercialized. And I'm not saying this is an exact analog of digital technology. You know, it's not easy. You can't just start something in your garage and hey presto, you've got a great healthcare business in 5 years' time. You know, the barriers to entry are huge. And it does require quite a lot of capital up front and risk taking up front. But you know, I think there are a wave of smaller business in the healthcare sector that should be able to be very successful over the next decade, and we, you know, we have been receptive to that. We've seen them come through the AIM market, and we've, you know, tried to establish significant positions in some of these companies. And you know, they're not all bleeding edge, you know, genetic engineering type things, but you know, they all have really interesting science, and I think they're part of this trend. And of course, you know, it's much more luck than good judgment on our part that COVID-19 has accelerated that development very significantly.
Yes, well, it's been one of the features of recent months, the separation in performance of sectors, and for entirely logical reasons, technology and the way all of us have adapted our life, which I'm sure will stay changed. And healthcare should be in receipt of substantial, you know, government assistance going forward. Those are the two sectors that people will have made the most money in recent months. Yeah. But it sounds like you've been comfortably overweight in both of them for quite a long time before.
Yeah, we've been gradually seeing that weighting increase. And that's accelerated this year. It's accelerated partly because we were very active actually in investing from the VCT in March, April time, really, well, even February as well, February, March, April, while the crisis was really sort of looming and then coming and hitting. We were making quite a lot of new investments, in part because a number of our portfolio companies we knew were going to need to raise more money. And we were, you know, had decided pretty much that we wanted to support their next round of funding. And when the crisis hit, you know, that acted as a trigger for them to say to themselves, well, if we're going to do this, we better do it now because we don't know where we're going to be in a few months' time. So really, there are a significant number of our portfolio companies that refinanced in the very early stages of the COVID-19 crisis. And it stood them in really good stead, actually, but it also allowed us to make a significant number of new investments, well, adding to holdings we already had.
I was going to ask about issuance, because one would naturally think of an IPO as a good place for a specialist fund like yourself to take a large position. And I'm sure that you get canvassed for your views on whether companies are ripe for listing yet or not. But it's been a pretty slow year. You can go back 12 months in terms of issuance onto AIM. So it sounds like, you know, your balance has shifted much more into secondary support, particularly for existing holdings. Is that a worry for you, or do you think, or can you see a little bit over the horizon with a decent list of potential IPOs coming over the hill?
Yeah, no, it's not a worry for me, actually. And in some ways, it's sort of what you'd expect going into a major crisis like the pandemic we've just been through, where IPO activity just stops because, you know, nobody, brokers or companies, want to take the risk on spending all that money on an IPO and then and failing. And investor appetite was destroyed in April, May. You know, you'd have been doing incredibly well to get a new company away during that period of time. So just caution meant that wasn't going to happen. But of course, companies that we knew already, those placings could happen very quickly. It wasn't expensive for the companies to have you know, to come to market to raise the funds. That's one of the beauties of being on AIM, actually. And it's one of the, you know, I hope it will be seen as one of the real attractions of going through the hassle and expense of floating a high growth company on AIM, is that you then, you know, you establish a pool of investors who understand the business well. And if you need the money quickly in a crisis like that, and you've got a good proposition, then you're going to be able to find it. And it's, you know, it's a tremendous kind of support for those businesses. And we had a couple that we knew were going to raise more money. We didn't know the exact timing, but we were very supportive of them. And in fact, you know, we actually ended up investing more money than I could have really hoped for in the first half of our financial year up to 31st of July, where we're investing, you know, nearly £12 million, I think it was, in that period of time. You know, which for the VCT is that's a big number, and we were able to add to some holdings which were really high conviction in. You know, so we've seen the companies like Polarian, which is now you know, it's one of the newest investments in the portfolio to make it into the top 10. You know, we've invested a lot of money in it, and the shares have done very well. You know, this is a company that is a diagnostics business, and we think they've got a really major new piece of technology and the ability to perform lung image lung scans, you know, using traditional MRI scanners with adding on Polarian's equipment. And effectively what they do is they do something called hyperpolarization, which is where you align the gravitational field of every atom in xenon gas. And they use there are several isotopes of xenon, one which has long been used in lung imaging for a process called scintigraphy, where they use xenon 131, which is a radioactive isotope of xenon. And what Polarian do is they use a non-radioactive isotope of xenon, therefore much, much safer, which is xenon 129. But they hyperpolarize it. And then when you get the patient to breathe that in, and you put them in an MRI scanner, and in a couple of minutes, you can develop this incredible 3D image of the lung. And the competition for this is really, you know, 40-year-old technology where you get a 2D black and white image of the lungs. You can broadly see if it's not working, but you can't see a lot of detail. And with the Polarin image, you can see massive detail. You can see exactly where the lung is functioning or not. And you can also see the kind of problem, if it's not functioning, the kind of problem it is. Is it the lung itself? Is it the epithelial layer? Is oxygen getting from the lung into the lung, but just not getting into the blood? There's been a lot of research done by research institutions using Polarin's device over the last few years. And they now believe that they can, with enough sort of different images that they've taken now, they can develop signatures. So when they see particular signatures and images, they can relate those to very specific types of lung disease, which in the past they would have really had no idea about. So, you know, we think actually this company, which will be filing for its FDA approval very shortly, actually, and should get the approval through early next year. That will be the catalyst for the company to sort of spring into life commercially. This has been a very long road to get here. This is 20-year-old technology. It was developed by GE a long time ago, and it's gradually come through many iterations. So actually, I feel very excited about having played some part in this coming to market, because I think it will make a tremendous difference to what's possible in terms of diagnosing lung diseases. That's now one of the top 10 holdings in the fund. It does already sell its products, but only to research institutions. They've sold about 24 of the devices, mostly in the States. But I think that, you know, that there's a good deal of excitement about this this having clinical use for the first time, hopefully next year.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned having the fortunate position of having cash to invest in March and April. Coming back to the VCT, you are and have been raising money again for the fund at the moment, don't you?
Yeah, we had a prospectus offer that we launched last November. We raised £25 million under that offer. But because we had a bigger than expected investment period in the first half of this year, plus what we were doing towards the end of last year, we felt that actually we could use the allowance we'd given ourselves in the prospectus to raise a further £20 million. It'd be very efficient in a way to use that now, build up cash in advance of what to answer your earlier question, I do think we're going to start to see some interesting new companies come to AIM over the next 6 months. We've started to get early looks at one or two. I'm excited about the potential now for new companies to list. I'm a big proponent of AIM for the right kind of companies at the right stage. I think it's a huge asset for UK PLC to have such a vibrant small companies market at our disposal. And we want to have cash available to back investments as they come through. As you'll know, the rules are very onerous. So VCTs can't raise too much money without starting to fall foul of the VCT legislation. But, you know, we've already invested a sufficient amount that even if we fill this offer up as 20 million, we will have met the first of the tests that applies, the 30% test. We will have met that already from investing we've done earlier this year. And so, it's not going to put us under any undue pressure from the point of view of the VCT legislation. We tend to be very conservative about that. We don't want to go anywhere near a situation where we have to go and look for qualifying investments because we kind of need them, in inverted commas. We're pretty cautious in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've had these tax discussions before, which people can find on the previous podcast. But within the boundaries of long-term stock selection that you are running, particularly for the VCT fund, how are you looking at the world playing out at the moment? I'm thinking more in terms of economic growth, the right background climate for growth companies to flourish in. Because, of course, again, one of the redeeming features of AIM is that it has a lot of companies with revenues coming from the Americas, from Japan, China, whatever it may be. It's a very international choice. And that surely must be a factor, again, when you look top down at the investments. Dare I say, not to be too overweight in the UK economy, where the consumer it has particular challenges. Brexit is going to have an impact volatility on the currency, as well as spending confidence in the month ahead, I'm sure. So how do you look at that? How do you factor in that top-down view where, again, with a weakening dollar and the fiscal policies in America, it's been a very good place to have exposure to for economic activity?
I'd say that as we went into the crisis and we saw the vast amount of money that was created in March, April, May, June, we took the view that actually you have to be in the market at the moment. That amount of cash creation ironically makes cash itself a very risky investment. And the risk is you just get hugely left behind, not just by rising asset prices around the world, but later on by inflation. So, I'm personally of the view, and this isn't everyone in the team, I've yet to persuade all of my colleagues about this, but I'm of the view that we're going to get surprise inflation coming through, and we'll get some economists caught out by this who have taken the view, well, we haven't seen inflation any time in the last 10 years. Why is it different this time around? You know, it didn't happen. Everyone was predicting it after 2010. Not me, incidentally, but, I'm not an economist. So why is it going to happen this time? You know, I think the answer to that question is, well, the amount of money that's been created is massively more this time around. And so with this kind of increase, this kind of expansion of the money supply, which, you have to look back to 1943, I think, to see an equivalent expansion of the money supply in Western markets. I think that has, that should profoundly shape our appetite for being in the market. And, as you'll know, there's a phrase used by those who sort of are more of an inflationary kind of mindset, and me too, that, this there is no alternative, or TINA, as it's called. Mm-hmm. If you're looking, well, what do I do with savings? Are you really going to go into bonds when you're going to might have negative rates or fractional rates? And you're just going to get wiped out by inflation if it appears. You might go into index-linked bonds, but actually it's quite hard to avoid the thought that actually just invest in a really good business that should grow with inflation if we do get inflation, or if we get inflation with very, very low real growth, which is what I'm kind of expecting. That's why cash would be very dangerous in that scenario, but good businesses will keep up with that and should exceed it. And so I think that's been part of the driver for why the stock market has apparently confounded lots of people's expectations. People thought, well, we've just been through such a massive drop in GDP. How can the market possibly go up? And the answer is, well, the money supply has increased more than you could ever have imagined. It's just there's been little chat about that relative to the chat about all the, you get the headlines of GDP drops 20% in the second quarter. That's the headline. Well, the other headline is not, money supply has just expanded, hugely in the second quarter, more than it's ever done any time we can remember. That doesn't feature in the conversation. So, we've taken the view the last few months that you have to be in this market. So in some ways, I think short term, I'm more confident in the market than many. Longer term, I've probably also got more profound questions, and there are things that do start to make me very uneasy about what's going on. I think one article I saw, it put it quite well, that the guardians of inflation are by and large asleep and have gone away and have given up, actually. And we'll start to see some rules rewritten. We've already kind of seen it in the US, where
I think that was the article would have been just after the last Fed meeting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we're sort of seeing that in the US, where they're starting to subtly rewrite the rules. The Federal Reserve, strangely, doesn't really look at money supply and doesn't seem to care about it much, which puzzles a lot of anyone with a sort of monetarist outlook, has basically thrown all of Milton Friedman's theory out of the window. So I think it's a little bit hasty. But on the other hand, longer term, this is now a cause for concern. We have to trust policymakers to be incredibly sure-footed and to, I suppose, it was the thought, actually, I had right at the beginning of QE that, you know, QE is a great problem solver. And it's a great way of postponing and putting off the pain that is caused by big recessions. And, you know, and we sail through them, we sail through the 2008 crisis, you know, with supposedly with austerity, but it wasn't really austerity. You know, the austerity we had in the UK, even though, yes, of course, it had a very nasty impact on many people, it was austerity of the kind which, you know, countries which really went through austerity wouldn't recognize. So, you know, you talk to the Greeks or you talk to the Estonians or even the Irish, you know, they went through austerity in a way that we never touched us, because we were able to print a lot of money to get out of it. And in a way, that what we're doing now is doing that on steroids and to a much greater degree. And you know, the worry over this is that it's a bit of a one-way street. You know, yes, it solves the problems, but how do you get out of it? How do you ever unwind it? And, you know, that this is my concern. And I think our politicians are now, you know, nobody wants to talk about austerity. Nobody wants to be even associated with the word austerity, whatever that means. But, you know, the old-fashioned word for it was prudence. And, you know, nobody, or balancing the books. You know, that has really completely gone out of fashion. And how do we ever get back to that kind of a situation? So in a sense, you know, another way that this is talked about is that we're conducting a huge monetary experiment, and we don't know if it works. We don't know where is the boundary to how much money you can create. And nobody can actually tell you that. But if you ever find out, you find out the hard way. So longer term, I'm kind of, you know, have some trepidation actually. But in the shorter term and you know, the outlook for equities over the kind of time frame we might try and analyze, I think it's a market that one has to look to join in with. And, you know, the policymakers are often more adept than we give them credit for. So, you know, but they have got some profound things to solve on the sort of 5 to 10 year horizon. And you know, I think there is going to be a need at some stage for, you know, a balancing the books kind of mentality to come back into fashion. And right now I scratch my head to think about how that actually might work in practice. You know, no one's going to win an election on that kind of basis. So how do we get there? And I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, so you're starting to depress me a little bit, Paul, though. But maybe we can just finish off by making the case for small caps in this environment, where, as you say, there's liquidity being pumped through the system, and that's mostly gone into larger companies because that is the easiest way to put that money to work. But yeah, in this scenario where there will be growth to be found, and we have embraced technology much more so than 6 months ago, why is that positive for small caps?
Well, you know, one of the beauties about small cap investing is that there are always new things happening, and there are always companies that are, you know, can be formed and find themselves in exactly the right place, and whatever the industrial trends are. And that's been true through every crisis, and even the crisis we've just been through. You know, there've been a handful of companies around who not just not affected by it, but were massive beneficiaries of it. And you know, because their business models just happen to come into their own in a pandemic, and you know, that phenomenon will always be there. And you know, it's the job of the fund managers in small cap investing to make sure we've got a really diversified portfolio. And you know, whatever does unfold, we've got some companies that are going to always be on the front foot and you know, bringing in the next things that are due to happen. So you know, another theme which I think we can all get excited about in the next few years will be the what we call energy transition. And you know, whether that's you know, transitioning the grid towards the ability to charge up millions of electric cars, which we're a long way from at the moment, or you know, repurposing our energy generation supply chain so that it's, you know, it's got more renewable energy in it than it currently does, and can manage a situation where we become less dependent on fossil fuels than we still are. You know, how do you, we've already made a fantastic job of transitioning towards greener energy sources, but there's still a long way to go. And there's you know, many small companies are developing really important pieces of technology, or they're somehow working on the supply chain that's going to contribute to that. And even, you know, even there's a natural resources story to talk about there too, where, you know, we might find companies that are able to bring the right natural resources to market. So, you know, there's a number of newer holdings in our small companies portfolio which reflect that. So, you know, one's called Cymec Atlantis, which is turning an old coal-fired power station in Wales to be powered from material that's made from recycled plastic and paper and cardboard. And, you know, I think that's a phenomenal use of an asset that's become redundant. You know, the beauty of it is it's already plugged into the grid. It's already on a train line, and it already sits next to a data center, so a huge consumer of electricity. You know, if they can bring that transition about, you know, I think it's going to be replicable into many other coal-fired power stations across Europe. So, you know, that's pretty exciting. It's the kind of thing where small companies kind of come into their own, because they can identify very specific new things that need to be done, and they can go and raise capital and innovate to allow that to happen. Another, you know, new, very small investment again in the small companies fund is called Ecutech. It's a company that is one of the world leaders in gasification technology. We think they've got some of the world leading expertise in gasification. And again, that's going to be, I think, going to be a really important part of our ability to generate power from, non-fossil fuel sources by putting it through a gasification process. It's much cleaner and more efficient than what we currently do, which is incineration. So, you know, incineration gets less power out of the material and it creates many more pollutants. And therefore it's also more expensive to do. I think gasification is going to be, you know, play an important part, and so on and so on. And there are many other examples. We think we're going to see some opportunities along those kind of lines in the VCT over the coming year. And it's one of the reasons for the fundraisers. We want to make sure we've got some money to invest in them if we see them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a suitably positive note on which to end on, because again, the swathes of the global population have experienced months without smog, which is or commuting. I won't compare the two in terms of stress. But that's, I think you're entirely right, where the responsiveness and the development of technology and solutions for what society needs is far more likely to come from the smaller, nimble, creative companies. So fingers crossed. Good luck raising the rest of the money for the AIM VCT. Anybody who's interested, just have a look at the share price since March. I think it's up about 50%. So there's some good stocks in there. And always good to talk to you, Paul. Thank you very much for your time. And we might come back and see what's happened in a few months' time.
It's a great pleasure, Andy. Thank you very much.